Can a work of fiction be the equivalent of a scientific breakthrough? Richard McGuire joins us to discuss his astonishing graphic novel Here.
And I was thinking, I'm going to do a story where that corner is divided into two spaces, and one's going to go forward in time, and one's going to go backward in time.
We play games for fun, but can they also make us less anxious and more productive? Can they stave off regret or even suicide? Simon Parkin will discuss his reviews of two new books on the power of gaming.
She says that her techniques can help with surgery and chronic pain, with migraines, with Crohn's disease, with healing a broken heart.
John Williams will be here with an update from the literary world and feedback from our readers, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. Standing in for Pamela Paul, I'm Barl Segal. So we're joined now by Richard McGuire, whose graphic novel Here is reviewed in this week's issue by Luc Sant, who calls it a revolutionary achievement. Welcome, Richard.
Hi.
So here is the story of the corner of a room in New Jersey from about 3 billion years BC, right, to the year 22,000 at least. So from primordial ooze to our alien selves. Tell me a little bit about how this book works.
When you open the book, the gutter of the book is actually the corner of a room. And it's a two-page spread of that space. In a way, the book architecturally works like you are entering the space as you open the book. And then when you turn the page, you never leave that perspective. It's a locked camera view of that room. And in the upper left corner, you have a date that tells you what year is going on. And then as the book progresses, it gets a little more complicated when you start having many, many panels with many, many dates. And then you have all the different stories interlaced.
When did you discover that you could do that? Because I think that's what Luc Sant says, like you poke holes in the space-time continuum by layering those panels. Like we're looking at 2014, say, right? And then we have like four other panels being 1906, 1609, from different scenes from that same space.
Right. I went to a lecture that Art Spiegelman gave about the history of comics. And my takeaway from that was just that comics were essentially diagrams, narrative diagrams. And when I got home, I had just moved into this new apartment, and I'm staring at the corner of the room, and I was thinking, I'm going to do a story where that corner is divided into two spaces, and one's going to go forward in time, and one's going to go backward in time. And then a friend visited and showed me his Windows program. He was telling me about his Windows program, because this is 1988, and that's when it hit me that I thought, I can have many windows with many time frames. So that's really what triggered the whole thing.
It's not just any corner of any room, right? Like this is a house with particular meaning to you.
Mm-hmm.
Where is this house? Where are we set?
Well, it's the house I grew up in. But before I did the book version, I did a six-page story, which was just, it wasn't so specific. And I felt that I had to flesh it out when I came to the book. So I had to really pick a place. And then I thought, I know a lot about my hometown. Yeah. So I thought, good place to start. And I knew there was a lot of history there.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I had to really dig for all the research.
So you did do a lot of research because Ben Franklin makes an appearance. The Revolutionary War sort of happens on the edges of the book. So
right. Well, I always knew there was some significance to the building across the street from where I grew up. And I thought that Ben Franklin had lived there. Mm-hmm. And then when I started doing research, I found out more that it was actually his son who was, it's actually a really complex story. And I kind of, the more I dug for that, I realized this is not the Ben Franklin stories. I had to dial back on that and just say, okay, it's just an argument between a father and son happening across the street. But it is kind of a little microcosm of the beginning of the country, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
When I started working on it, I had this motto to myself where I'll make all the big things small and the small things big. And I thought that was exactly that kind of example.
Well, give me an example of one of the small things you made big.
The small things big. I suppose it's just the little tiny movements of people. I mean, gestures, somebody like touching a hand or just like, you know, it's all about the small movements. I think it's more primarily about that than it is about anything else because it's like the moments that are undocumented. That's really what the book is about.
I was wondering if there is memoir nested in the book somehow, even subtly? Because it's set in your childhood home.
Yeah, there is. There are a lot of things that are meaningful for me. You know, as I was writing the book, my parents passed away and my older sister passed away and the family house, we had to close up.
So
we had to, like, you know, it was the whole process of, like, you know, getting rid of all this stuff. And And then when you're there and you're going through boxes and boxes of stuff and looking at old photos and stuff, you just get a rush of all these memories. And a lot of the images from the book are really taken from family photos. And but there's a lot of little personal things. There's a few dreams of mine that enter into the book. And
are characters taken from life? Are they more sort of composites or creatures of your imagination?
Well, most of my family, I mean, I have cousins in there. And my brothers and sisters, you know, there's also a lot of made-up stuff. I mean, especially when it comes to the future, which was a difficult area to get into. But I knew, like, even when I was doing my research, when it was right around the time when I was working on the book that the Sandy hurricane happened, and then I was looking at these projection maps of the area, and it's inevitably going to be underwater at some point. So those things were kind of almost a given. But
I was wondering because, you know, we don't really follow one person in the book. We don't really follow one family just because the scope is so huge, right? And we don't even follow the house necessarily because it's, you know, we meet that land before there was a house, before there was even civilization. So I was trying to figure out that issue of like, who is the protagonist or who are we following in this story? Do you have a sense of...
I worried about that. I worried the fact that without a protagonist, that you wouldn't feel anything.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, I was kind of surprised when people were telling me how they were moved by the book, and I'm happy that that was the case. I suppose, you know, time itself is the protagonist because it's not the room.
It's interesting. So the book, as you're reading it, you could almost read it from anywhere.
Right.
But it does have an arc, but it's very, at least for me, it feels very musical in that there are refrains, things sort of come back.
Right.
Epithets, insults will suddenly come back. A gesture will come back.
Right,
so I was wondering, how did you even begin to understand how all of these stories could intersect? How did you keep track of them?
When I started to expand it into the book, I was actually nervous about going from 6 pages to 300 pages. And I have a musical background, so I really feel that seemed when I kind of put up all the pages on the wall of my studio, and I could see it as like a musical score, and I could just try to find the internal rhythms that were just happening naturally. That's when I realized that's how to go with this.
The book feels like a song to me in that there are these deaths that happened.
Right.
There are births as well as deaths.
Right.
There is decay. The house falls apart. There is, as you say, environmental catastrophe. We see water entering.
Right.
But it doesn't feel ponderous. It doesn't feel depressing.
Oh, that's good.
No, I mean, it really doesn't. Like, even though, I mean, these things feel sort of like inevitable in a gentle way.
Right. Well, I was hoping to have just a natural balance of those kind of forces. See, you know, it's funny when you were talking about the arc of it, you know, I think I did it while I was working on the book. I was also working on an electronic version of it. And in that version, the ebook version, it remixes all the book.
Oh, interesting.
And so, but I felt like the book, because of its form, has a natural arc of beginning and end, so I felt that I had to compose it for the book. But I was really excited about having the electronic version do the remix version of the book. And also there's a little bits of animation that move in real time in that version too. So.
Yeah. Did you have other antecedents as you were working on this? Like influences, things that sort of...
I'm always jumping around from medium to medium because I've done animation, I've done music. So I think I brought those things into this project. I haven't done a lot of comics. It's not, but I also felt as I was doing this that the strength of comics is that it can do something like this. The simultaneousness can't exist in any other form. If you did this in film and all those panels were moving, you wouldn't know where to look. It's as if you wrote it as a novel, it would be like, this happened, and meanwhile, this is happening. And it's like, it's too linear. Writing a novel, at least in the comic medium, it's really exploits this, or it's possible to exploit this nonlinear aspect of storytelling.
Did you enjoy making this book?
I did for a lot of it, but I have to say it was pretty painful too, because there was moments of a lot of self-doubt because I didn't realize I could do such a big project. Just the idea of expanding it to 300 pages.
Let alone how many millennia.
Yeah, and you know, I actually did sign a contract years before. I signed the contract in 2000, and I suddenly got an offer to go to France and work on an animated film. And I was like, okay, this is a once-in-a-lifetime thing. I'm going to do this. And then I did, And then when I got back, it was a few years later, and then I was like, okay, I'm going to get back to the book. So in some write-ups, it says I've been working on this book for 25 years or something. I mean, I've only worked on it for 3 years, which is, I think, a normal length
for
a book.
So you procrastinated for 22 years.
Oh, I wouldn't call it that. I put things aside, but I just didn't know how to get into it. It took me a long time to figure that out, how to expand it. And when I realized that I could use the form of the book and have that open page be the double page spread, which is the corner of the room, that was the big step forward to realize how to go about it.
Thank you so much, Richard.
Okay, thank you.
Richard McGuire, whose graphic novel Here is reviewed in this week's issue by Luc Sant. John Williams is here with an update from the literary world and feedback from our readers. Hi, John.
Hey, Pearl.
So what's going on?
I'm filling in for Alexandra this week. A lot of understudies going on the podcast. And the big news this week was the announcement of the winner of the Man Booker Prize, which was announced on Tuesday. And the winner was Marlon James for his novel, A Brief History of Seven Killings.
Yeah, and the first Jamaican, right?
The first Jamaican-born writer to win the prize. And obviously the Booker in the last couple of years has opened itself up to, it used to be open to British writers and writers from the Commonwealth countries. And now it is open to, I believe, any novel that is available in the English language.
Right.
And so the nominees and the places they're from have become more diverse in recent years, and so James is the first Jamaican-born winner. And this is a very sprawling, big novel that sort of takes off from a moment in 1976, the attempted assassination of the reggae star Bob Marley, and then goes from there into just an incredible number of plots and subplots covering Jamaican history, Cuban exiles, CIA operatives.
Right,
there's
right.
all kinds of...
And parts and chapters are in patois, I think, and it's...
Yeah, you know, it's both a challenging and a fun book, I think.
Yeah.
And he said, actually, that he first envisioned it as a short crime novel, which is very funny because when you look at it now, it's both, the spine is very big. And also when you look into it, you can just tell it's a very dense and complex book.
Yeah. Oh, it's interesting because now to sort of think about like this book and then you can think about the Garth Risk Hellberg. And it does seem to be like, again, is it that a fashion for big, culture spanning, formally inventive books are back in fashion again?
They seem to be. And even if they don't span... that far, Hanya Yanagihara's novel, A Little Life, which has gotten a ton of great press this year and which a lot of readers love, was a finalist for the Booker Prize and is also shortlisted for the National Book Award.
That's right. And it clocks in at about like 900
Yeah, it's
pages.
A very big book. And I think I do, for whatever reason, I think there's an appetite for that, maybe because, as we go digital and people are reading shorter things all the time, maybe they want to sometimes kick back with something massive and epic.
Yeah, but kind James's of like a binge novel read.
Yes, a binge read. And he said, he himself in an interview this week in relation to the prize said, I'm not an easy writer to like, when he was describing his experimental style. I don't think that's true, given the affection that there is out there for this book and his previous ones. This is his third novel. His first was called John Crow's Devil. That was in 2005. And in 2009, he published The Book of Night Women. So this is obviously a huge moment in James's career.
And for Jamaican literature, which I wonder,
absolutely
great things for other writers coming down.
Yeah, and I think he said, he also said that he hopes it brings more attention to what's coming out of Jamaica and the Caribbean, and there's no doubt, I think, that it will.
Great. So we also posed a question to our listeners this week.
We did. On Twitter, given that this week's issue is based on comic books and graphic novels and science fiction and thrillers, we asked people what the best graphic novel they read this year was. And they took it broadly, and they didn't just stick to books that were published this year.
Yeah, yeah.
And we also got a ton of response. There was just an avalanche. So apologies to the writers, the readers that we don't get to. I'm just going to highlight a few here. And everyone else can go to @NYTimesBooks and look at what some of the other people recommended. Someone who tweets as Clean Record and someone named Abby Davis were among the many people who named Richard McGuire's Here. And you talked to McGuire earlier in this episode about that very innovative book. A couple of readers, including Sophie FP at Sophie Plappert, mentioned The Encyclopedia of Early Earth by Isabel Greenberg, which is a book about a young boy who lived in a civilization, a sort of now lost civilization before human time, and it draws on myth and a sort of epic adventure he takes, and he falls in love, and it sounds like a very interesting book. I actually hadn't seen it before these people recommended it on Twitter. A reader named Stevie Ray recommends a graphic novel called Pretty Deadly, and he says, if you love westerns / supernatural / folklore / beautifully ghoulful illustrated graphics, then this one is for you. I think he may have termed the word
ghoulful.
Ghoulful.
Sold
it.
In any case.
Yeah. In my cart. Yeah. A reader named John Freeman and another named Jamie Gambell recommended The Motherless Oven by Rob Davis. Mm. Freeman called it bonkers, visionary, brilliant, and says a sequel is in the works. So I looked this up, too, because I hadn't heard of it either. A reader review somewhere recommended it as, imagine if Kurt Vonnegut wrote Catcher in the Rye. And it's set in a very odd world where it rains knives and where children make their parents. Parents don't make children. And this one character's parents are... One of them is sort of a brass contraption with a sail, and the other is a hairdryer. His mother is a hairdryer. So obviously there's no imagination at work here. It's a very straightforward, same old story. And that's The Motherless Oven by Rob Davis. And finally, several people, including Sarah Maltzman Shaw, Elizabeth Mahoney, the author Tim Federle, and someone who tweets simply as Mr. Smith. I'm not sure how he got that handle. That's pretty good. Recommended El Defo by C.C. Bell.
Oh, great.
And that is sort of it is a graphic novel, but it also is kind of a children's book, very comic looking, and it deals with it's an autobiographical book based on the author's loss of hearing at a very young age and how she dealt with it in school. And the characters who look otherwise human have these kind of long rabbit ears, which is a funny way of pointing out the importance of hearing in the story.
And C.C. Bell is actually in this issue. She contributes a small little drawing. We asked a bunch of our favorite sort of graphic novelists to show us in one panel the power of graphic storytelling. So she's got a great, very funny little installment.
It's very clever, and the characters in her panel also have
those
ears that I was describing, so readers should go check that out.
Okay, thank you so much, John.
Thanks, Parle.
So we're joined now by Simon Parkin in London. Simon has reviewed two new books on gaming culture in this issue. Hi, Simon.
Hi there. Hey.
So, Simon, the first book you take on is Super Better by Jane McGonigal, a proponent of gamification. What is gamification? It's not gaming, is it?
Not just gaming, no. The idea of gamification is really to turn mundane tasks into something that's enjoyable and, you know, even something alluring. By framing them as a kind of contest that can be won. So you might take the idea of going for a 5-mile walk, and if you do that, and then you award yourself with a certain number of points. You know, these points aren't necessarily anything real or tangible, but you're kind of giving yourself awards and points and accruing experiences as you do so, and it's really a way to kind of incentivize a to-do list in that way.
Okay, and where did some of these ideas come from?
So gamification has been around for a few years now, and Jane McGonigal, the author of the book, is kind of one of the proponents of that. She's delivered a lecture at TED, for example, on this subject. In terms of Super Better, this specific book, this came out of an injury that McGonigal sustained, which left her with really severe headaches and depression. And as a way to work her way out of this fog, she decided to kind of frame her recovery like a game, and set herself little manageable tasks that she could do each day. And by kind of getting through those tasks and being able to cross them off, she found that she was able to get through her illness in some way.
Okay, like what kinds of tasks? Were these like physical therapy things? Were these sort of more cognitive challenges? What kinds of things was she sort of incentivizing?
Right, so it's a variety of different tasks. So it can be, there are 100 of them that she sets down in the book, because the idea is that you'll try some of them for yourself,
right.
and they range from
very simple too.
Some of them are very simple, yeah. So it could be just, I think one of the earliest ones is, stand up and stretch for a few seconds, or spend 30 seconds looking out of the window, things that are very, very manageable. And then they become slightly more complex as the book goes along. And, it can be like as many posts as you can on Facebook within a couple of minutes, or, or ones that are, make sure that you drink plenty of water. And, in every case, they're quantified in some way. So to make the... I guess self-care aspect of it, turn it into some kind of quantified challenge
right.
that can be mastered.
And sort of the claims that it seems like McGonagall and other proponents of gamification make are huge. They say it sort of can stave off depression, anxiety, even help you through major illnesses, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And she does have some scientific kind of clinical studies to back up these claims. They carried out a couple of clinical trials in which people undertook the program that she's established here, and you know reported feeling good about themselves and seeing recovery and improvement and all of those kind of things. And she says that she regularly gets correspondence from people who have adopted her techniques and have found them hugely beneficial to their lives. Mm-hmm. She does offer the disclaimer that says that the people who went through the trials were in many cases also undergoing therapy and,
right.
and other kinds of treatment at the same time. So, you know, quite where the boundaries lie between where the benefits were coming from aren't entirely clear, of
right.
course. But yeah, she says that there's evidence that these things do help people. Now,
yeah.
I wonder whether many of the tasks that she's kind of providing readers with here are tried and tested
mm-hmm.
Techniques of self-care, basically. You know,
mm-hmm.
do exercise, keep yourself mentally stimulated, make sure that you're remaining hydrated, all of these kind of things that she's framing as game-like tasks,
right.
but which are, of course, you know, useful techniques for any human being who wants to stay healthy.
Yeah.
Whether the benefits are just coming from these age-old techniques of how to live well, or
mm-hmm.
whether they're coming from her framing,
mm-hmm.
is kind of up for debate, I think.
But what about some of the bigger claims? How persuasive do you think those are, that gamification can really work for bigger kinds of mental illness or bigger kinds of illness and despair in general?
That's where I start to feel more uncomfortable with some of the claims in the book. She kind of says that, you know, as well as depression and anxiety, her techniques can help with surgery and chronic pain, with migraines, with Crohn's disease, with healing a broken heart,
mm-hmm.
Finding a job after years of unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
And then even more seriously, you know, she's saying that people have you know, with terminal diagnoses like stage 5 cancer and ALS disease have also used the techniques and found them beneficial. Now, you know, I don't want to say that none of that's true, but at the same time, it's as a reader, you start to feel maybe
right.
slightly more uncomfortable about the idea that standing up, for example, or drinking a glass of water is in any really meaningful way kind of providing healing to these more serious diseases.
Yeah. You also review a book of essays in your review, a book called State of Play, edited by Daniel Goldberg and Linus Larsson. And it's a sort of sweeping survey of new writing as well as sort of important, iconic writing about video games. And I was wondering, what are the kinds of questions people are posing, or how is video game culture sort of interrogating itself right now?
Well, it's certainly a very interesting time in terms of the video game medium at the moment. The democratization of game-making tools
mm-hmm.
in the last few years have had the effect that it's just much easier for anyone to pick up some software, design a game, and through things like the App Store, you know, on Apple iPhones, or Steam, which is basically the iTunes for video games on PCs, you're able to release your game to a global audience, you know, all from your bedroom. And the, you know, the effect of that change, where prior to this, you would need to, you know, a team of 20
right.
to 50 people working for 2 years, you know, with very specialized software, and then you'd need to, you know, broker deals with companies like Nintendo and Sony to get your game onto their consoles. You know, this kind of revolution that's happened in the last few years has made it that, you know, we've got a far wider range of voices making video games, basically,
mm-hmm.
and not always, you know, in the obvious commercial ways, you know, of racing games or football games. We're now seeing games about, you know, living with terminal illness, or you know, the experience of a trans person walking down the street,
mm-hmm.
and you know, this chance, you know, this influx of new kinds of games has had the effect of broadening and deepening the type of criticism and commentary that's happening around games. And I think in this book we get a scattershot of those different approaches.
Right.
You know, it's not particularly cohesive in one sense, but it does offer, you know, a snapshot of all these different areas, you know, of conversation that are happening around video games at the moment.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up criticism, because you end your review, you have this great kicker, and you say, you know, just paraphrasing, that, you know, State of Play works well as a manifesto because it sort of makes the point that to criticize gaming isn't to betray it, and it's not an effort to censor anybody, but it can make both the games better and it can make the community better and sort of safer for other people. And I was wondering, is there something about gaming or gamers that makes them or the community a little bit more sensitive to criticism? Because it does seem to be something very loaded.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think if you look at the broader historical context for video games, we've had three decades where the mainstream media message has been video games are basically terrible.
Right.
They're bad for you, they cause violence, they distract us from more important things in our lives. And a lot of the time, that criticism has not been very rigorous or thoughtful, and it's had the effect that for the millions of people who love video games have become very sensitive, basically, to criticism, I think. And, you know, as if the establishment, be that, you know, established media or government, just haven't thought enough about video games and what the benefits are and what's good about it. And so now we're at a stage where we're having more nuanced criticism about the medium, more thoughtful writing about the medium from people that have been playing video games for a very long time, that are familiar with the text, as it were. Mm. And yet, I think a lot of gamers are struggling to get out of the mindset of this is another attack and we need to be tremendously defensive. And we've certainly seen that in the last couple of years, some of the culture wars that have been going on in and around the video game scene.
Well, thank you so much, Simon.
Thank you.
Again, that was Simon Parkin, who reviews Super Better by Jane McGonigal and State of Play, edited by Daniel Goldberg and Linus Larson. We're joined now by Greg Coles with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Pearl.
What's going on?
Quite a lot. There are 6 new titles on the fiction list this week. Starting down at number 15, Debbie McComber has a novel called Dashing Through the Snow. It's a Christmas novel. It doesn't seem to be part of her Cedar Cove or Rose Harbor series, but she does every year or so do a Christmas novel, and this is one of those. Then up at number 13... John Sanford, the thriller writer, has a science fiction novel he wrote with the online photographer Katine. This book is called Saturn Run, new at number 13. It's kind of a first contact novel. Then at number 12, Geraldine Brooks's latest historical novel. This one goes all the way back to King David. It's called The Secret Chord, lifting from Leonard Cohen there, new at number 12. Then at number 8, the fantasy writer Brandon Sanderson has his latest kind of fantasy thriller called Shadows of Self, new at number 8. Then jumping all the way up to number 2, another fantasy thriller writer, George R.R. Martin, not the book 6 of the Song of Ice and Fire Westeros series that fans are waiting for. That book, Winds of Winter, is rumored to arrive in 2016 and to be 1,500 pages long.
Oh my
so,
God.
So clear your calendar now and some shelf space. But in the meantime, he has been delivering some prequels to that series. And this is the third of 3 prequels called A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, new at number 2. Finally, new at number 1 this week, Vince Flynn, who died of prostate cancer back in 2013 when he was just 47 years old, was working on this novel, The Survivor, when he died. And his estate and publisher turned to a thriller writer named Kyle Mills, who's got a dozen thrillers to his name, to finish that book. And they also signed him up to write 2 new books featuring Vince Flynn's hero, Mitch Rapp.
And in nonfiction, what's happening?
Nonfiction, there are 7 new titles. Between singer-songwriters and the Kennedy family, we could basically do the entire nonfiction list this week. Starting down at number 14, the singer-songwriter and rocker John Fogerty, the leader of Creedence Clearwater, has a book called Fortunate Son, which he wrote with Jimmy McDonough. Then at number 13, again, a singer-songwriter, Sarah Bareilles has a memoir called Sounds Like Me, new at number 13, continuing a recent trend of female singer-songwriters who are writing best-selling memoirs.
That's right. There's been Chrissy Hynde. Who else has there been recently?
Well, Patti Smith is
That's
back
right.
on the list. We'll get to her in just a minute.
Okay.
Up at number 8, Ben S. Bernanke, not a singer-songwriter to my knowledge. The former chairman of the Federal Reserve has written a memoir of his time at the Fed called The Courage to Act, really largely about the financial crisis of 2008 and the various crises.
And in a tradition of his own, Greenspan wrote a memoir after his time. You know, it does seem to be its own genre.
Right, suddenly.
My time at the Fed, yeah.
The Fed, which was formerly kind of this obscure organization, is suddenly all about transparency after the fact.
Of a kind.
Yeah, of a kind. Then at number 6, I mentioned the Kennedys, and here's the first book, Rosemary, by Kate Clifford Larson. It's a biography of the Kennedys' oldest daughter, who had severe mental and intellectual disabilities. It looks at how the family treated her. Really, a very sad story.
Yeah, and it's been making a huge, huge stir. I mean, part it's anything Kennedy gets people interested, but it's also there's something more with this book.
It goes back to. It kind of looks at family ambitions, you know, which are always at play with the Kennedys, but also at how America historically has treated people outside the mainstream.
Right.
It gets into this whole question of she got a lobotomy, she was institutionalized.
Right.
It was basically the family just kind of pretended she didn't exist. And it's this very sad, they never really reconciled her presence in to their ambitions.
Yeah.
Then at number 4, another Kennedy, this is Ted Kennedy's son, Patrick J. Kennedy, has written a book called A Common Struggle, also about mental illness. Mm-hmm. He wrote it with Stephen Fried, and it's a memoir of his own mental illness, especially bipolar disorder and addiction, and the work that he's done since as an advocate for mental health research. Then at number 3, I promised you we would talk about Patti Smith.
And there she is.
There she is, new on the list. Her second memoir called M Train. Uh-huh. Her first one, Just Kids, of course, won the National Book Award a few years ago.
So does this one pick up where the other one left off in any way?
Not really. The earlier one was truly a memoir of her youth in Greenwich
Portrait
Village.
Of
her,
artist,
yeah,
sort of
exactly. It was her friendship with Robert Mapplethorpe was really central to that book. This book is more stream of consciousness. It's kind of following Patti Smith's train of thought. She never quite spells out what M train stands for, but it might be mental or mind or you know, memory.
Yeah.
She's reflecting a lot on her reading life, on her music life, and there's a lot in there about loss, the death of her husband, the death of her brother. She travels to different kind of literary and musical touch points throughout it, and she drinks a lot of coffee in this book. so it's a very reflective, kind of quiet book, not so much a direct follow-up to Just Kids.
Yeah.
No. And then finally, the last new book on the nonfiction side of things is a political book. The Republican presidential candidate and former neurosurgeon Ben Carson has written another book with his wife, Candy Carson, not the first book they've done together, called A More Perfect Union. And it is from Ben Carson. It's just a look at what America might do to improve from his perspective.
Thank you so much, Greg.
Thank you, Parle.
Thanks for listening. For more information, go to nytimes.com/books. For the New York Times, I'm Parul Sehgal. See you next week.